Welcome to Lyme and Beyond with Tanya. I'm so glad you guys are tuning into this episode. Whatever it is that you're dealing with today specifically or going through at the moment, I just hope that your takeaway from this episode is going to give you what you need. Is it hope, inspiration, validation, some tips on how to treat this or detox more affordable? Whatever it is that you need today, I hope that that's what you get from this episode. And if you want to continue to help me share my voice and our voice in the community, please go into the about of this podcast, scroll to the bottom, click on that donation link. Hi, listeners. Welcome to Lyme and Beyond with Tanya. I wanted to make sure you all listened to the July 31st episode with Stephen Davis, the founder of the Nikki Watch technology. As you would have heard, he has been so generous as to gift a watch to one of my listeners. So you'll want to be sure to get into this amazing drawing. If you'd like to enter to win a free Nikki watch, you'll need to follow and like my podcast and email me your name and phone number to limeandbeyondwithtanya@gmail.com. Be sure and enter as you may just be the lucky winner. I will be doing the drawing on my September 11th episode, so be sure to listen in and see if I announce your name. As always, thank you so much for being such dedicated listeners. It's your support that allows me to continue to produce these episodes full of hope and inspiration. Today, my guest is not only a Lyme conqueror, but her kind of journey with Lyme disease and POTS and probably a whole bunch more stuff is kind of what drove her to turn her kind of career path into helping others battle chronic illness. And she is the founder of Case Integrative Health, which she started back in 2019. So I'm super excited to welcome Dr. Kelly to the show. We're going to talk about her Lyme journey, kind of maybe if there were things she would have done different knowing what she knows now, and about her practice and how she goes about kind of starting the navigation journey with the individual patients that she does, and just kind of talk about all the stuff. So super excited to have you on the show, Dr. Kelly. Thank you so much for joining me.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Absolutely. I love it when I have a patient and then also a doctor, right? Because you kind of, it's interesting to hear, you know, gosh, well, during my journey, I did this, but now that I know this, I would have done this differently, right? So it gives you just a whole wider array of experience, I think, when we go from actual patient to doctor. You know, we like to say that, you know, there's a lot of really great Lyme doctors nowadays, but still, like, they don't get it unless you get it, right? That phrase. And so I love having somebody that has had it all. So I truly appreciate it. And I'm looking forward to hearing your journey.
Yeah, I mean, my journey starts like so many others. You know, I started off feeling kind of sick and didn't know why, didn't think much of it. And I kind of had every excuse in the book as to why this was going on. It actually started for me in college. I started getting really winded walking up the hill to my dorm. And I thought that was weird because I was very athletic in high school. I did track and show choir and dance and all the things. And all of a sudden I couldn't walk up the hill. That's weird, you know? And I would be really, really tired. And I just assumed it was college. You know, it's bigger workload, et cetera, et cetera. But I did go to the doctor. I got diagnosed with asthma. I 100% do not think that's what it was. You know, I got an asthma inhaler. It didn't help a lick because I don't think asthma was my issue in hindsight, right? But I knew something was off. But I just kept plugging forward because I had things I wanted to do with life. And so I just kind of kept going. And it wasn't until med school, actually, where it really started to come to a head. And again, I just thought it was med school.
Right. Well, and that can do a lot, right? Like, a lot of hours and a lot of studying. And so, who wouldn't think, right? It's almost kind of no different than starting college, med school versus like having children, right? You're just overstressed. You're overworked, right? Yeah. That's what we think.
Yeah. So it's so easy to chalk it up to that, right?
Yeah.
But like most meds or like a lot of med students, I started to read about things and kind of thought, oh, I have this. Oh, I have that. I have this. So it's this hypochondriac type of thing that can happen to med students where every disease you read about, you think you might have. But I read about POTS, postural orthostatic tachycardia syndrome. And I said, that actually, I think that's what I have. Because I would stand up and feel really dizzy and lightheaded, like I was going to pass out. My heart would race upon standing, like I was running a marathon. It would get up to 170 beats per minute just from standing. I lost a lot of weight. I couldn't keep up with the demands of energy of school. My brain wasn't working the way that it used to. You know, I couldn't connect the dots between concepts as easily. And digestion issues and, you know, the works, right? But it kind of centered around the POTS idea. And I went to the doctor and I ended up talking them into giving me a tilt table study. And I don't know if you've heard of this. Have you heard of a tilt table study?
I have, yes.
Oh, they are the worst. It's like Hannibal Lecter. You get strapped to a bed and they push you upright. So you're kind of standing up and they monitor your vital signs the whole time, trying to get you to pass out.
Yeah.
To prove that you have it.
It's a crazy test. And I'm thinking just doing the test would make my body respond, right?
It's awful.
But it's also interesting that you learned about this in your med school, right? And so, because I know
nothing about Lyme, just POTS.
Just POTS, yeah.
That's how I kind of got onto it. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. And so we tried several different medications. I tried a fludrocortisone, which is a type of steroid. I tried SSRIs. I tried multiple things. Nothing really made me feel any better. But at least I had an answer as to what I thought what it was. And so I could learn how to manage it a little better with compression stockings, with salt water, and just got myself through and managed to get through residency, which was also torture, just feeling sick and, you know, standing on rounds and having, you know, attending physicians yell at you and trying to ask you questions where you're just trying not to pass out or throw up on them. It was really heart wrenching and hard to do.
You're a rock star for making it through.
I'm stubborn. We'll put it that way. I'm stubborn. It's not always a good thing, but I am stubborn. But in med school, I realized that there was something missing in medicine. You know, we are very quick to try to fit everyone into this diagnostic box and then give them a medication that fits with that. And then when they have a side effect from that medication, we give them another medication. And it just kept going. And I felt like there was a huge lack of curiosity.
Yeah.
Why is this patient sick? Why is this happening? What is going on? And so in med school, I actually started to learn more about more natural health options, more holistic style medication or medicine. And in residency is where I really started to push that and go to conferences to learn more about holistic and integrative medicine. Back then it was still the American Holistic Medical Association. And I found people who thought the same way. There were doctors who had been doing this for a while who thought differently and wanted to approach things differently and wanted to help patients differently. And that really, really resonated with me. And I knew in residency, I'm a family medicine doc. So we are kind of jacks of all trades.
Right.
Right.
We had a little bit of everything. Yeah.
Exactly. And, you know, when it comes to integrative medicine, everything is everything. So much of the medical system is in silos, and the heart's here and the gut's here and the brain's here, but family medicine and integrative medicine, it's the whole body. It's the whole person. It's even the whole community and the family, right? As part of that. So it all kind of fed nicely into that.
Yeah. And I think that's why it's so amazing, because we don't just put a label on something that you have and give a medication for it, right? Like, we look at the whole body.
Try to find that root cause.
Yes.
Why is this happening to you?
Yes. And some people do, but I love the choice of words that you used about curiosity, right? Like, that's a great word, because they just, you know, kind of with anything in this world, some people go to work to get a paycheck, and some people go to work to truly do their job and help people, right? And so I think not enough people have curiosity or have that ambition to want to do more than just show up and get a paycheck, right? And so that curiosity word is great. I like it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think that's, you know, integrative medicine.
Yeah.
For me, is that curiosity. And it was it was after residency. I tried, you know, again, several medications just to kind of get myself through residency. And after that, when I was off doing these more holistic conferences, I started hearing about Lyme disease. It's like, oh, you know, that's really controversial. I'm not sure I want to learn about that. Doctors are losing their license about that. You know, I'm just starting off. I don't know if I want to jump into that. But Lyme disease, Bartonella, these things can cause POTS. And it kept coming back to that. And I said, okay, fine. I'm listening. I will do this. I don't remember having a tick bite. I don't remember having a bullseye rash. You know, I grew up in small town Ohio. I went to Girl Scout camp in the woods. You know, I ran around in my yard barefoot all summer long. The possibilities are there,
right,
where I could have gotten a tick bite. I never remember hearing about it, talking about it, thinking about it. Yeah. No idea. So I don't know when I contracted it, but when I finally got tested, lo and behold, and I have its buddies too, some Bartonella and Babesia thrown in there in the mix as well. You know, my little entourage.
Of course, you're an overachiever, right?
Right. Can't just do one.
Right.
And when I finally got treatment and started to treat myself for that and started to really open up and see that I had patients suffering from similar things and testing them for it, you know, it just kind of snowballs. And once you start looking for it and finding it and helping people, you can't stop, because it is the underlying cause for so many people's hidden, mysterious, complex, chronic illness. And if you can help sort that out and help people feel better, it's right. Awesome. Like this right. That's the coolest part of my job is getting to help people. So, but I had to go through it. You know, I had to go through that for me, it was always the fatigue, the brain fog, the tachycardia, orthostatic issue. Those were my issues. I didn't have major pain issues.
Okay.
Gut issues. Definitely had some gut issues peppered in there too. But I went through the whole rigmarole. I did antibiotics until my mouth broke out in horrible ulcers. And I said, okay, we're done.
Okay.
And then I did herbs. And each time I did something different, I would get to another level, some benefits. And then I did some IV therapies. So I did some intensive ozone and silver IVs, UV and ozone saunas and all kinds of fun stuff.
Two of my favorite things, silver and ozone.
And that's really what brought me to the next level, where I really felt, okay, I can conquer this. I'm in a better spot. And I feel at this point I'm in remission. I haven't really taken much of anything for a long, long time, but it took a long time to get to that spot.
Yeah. So since we just brought up the topic of silver, you did IV silver.
I did.
Can you talk a little bit about, because I know that there's probably a lot of listeners out there that, you know, well, there's just so many rumors about just everything, right? But a lot of people are like, oh, if you do too much silver, you're going to turn blue, this or that. I never personally did silver through IV, but I ingested a lot of it during my journey. So can you kind of talk a little bit about the differences of orally versus IV and a little bit about that? That would be great.
Yeah. And I don't think the IVs are right for everyone necessarily. It's kind of a big on taking because you have to get a PICC line and all this other rigmarole. And it's not meant for every person, but
for the silver, you have to get
for the silver. Mm-hmm. It's kind of irritating to the veins. So you shouldn't do it through a regular IV. You can end up with phlebitis, which is an inflammation of your blood vessels or worse. So it really needs to be in a PICC line. And you know, those an extra level that not everyone's able to do. Right.
And maybe that's why I didn't do it via IV, because I was completely against the PICC line. And I got, during my treatment, I got new IVs every day of the week for like months. And I mean, I literally looked like a druggie when I left there. I'm like, are my veins ever going to be okay again? And actually they kind of were. They some of the doctors like, yeah, you've got really juicy veins. I'm like, oh wow, I didn't think I was going to have any veins left.
I still only think I have a couple,
but yeah. So that's good to know that it should be done through a PICC line.
It really should. Yeah. And it's a longer term treatment. It's something you kind of have to do for a longer period. So it's not even my go-to for treatment for patients these days. It's still definitely an option. But the biggest thing with silver that everyone has a question about is turning blue. And nano silver, which is typically what we're using in oral or IV forms, which is different even than colloidal silver. So just think of them as kind of tinier, more uniform particles versus colloidal, which is a little chunkier, if microscopically chunkier, right? Yeah. Versus people who are making their own silver at home. And if you're making your own silver at home and you do it improperly and you make perhaps, say, a silver salt, that's where you're going to come into trouble. And those are the people who are going to turn blue. And it is permanent. It's a permanent blue. And people will Google it and get scared because it's a permanent change. But that is when you're using silver salts. So silver medications that we're using in IV for sure, and oral preparations, the mass, you know, big ones on the market, are none of them are going to turn you blue.
Okay.
They're very safe. They're very different. And silver's awesome. I mean, the reason we have silverware is because it's antimicrobial. Nothing would grow on the silver. They used to put silver coins in a bucket of water to help with cleaning, purifying the water. I can't promise how well that worked, but nothing will grow on the silver. And we use silver topicals on burn patients to help with their healing. Yeah, and prevent infection. So, you know, we know silver has these uses, and it can also amplify antibiotic strength, if you will. So there are some studies with people who had a resistant form of a bacteria, and it was resistant to an antibiotic, but they added the silver to the antibiotic and now it treated the infection. Okay. So it's got some really cool properties to it. And it's generally pretty well tolerated if you take it properly, but like everything else, it can cause die-off reactions and Herxheimer-like reactions as well.
Right. Yes. That's interesting. I kind of learned that. I started making my own silver. I bought an actual brewer kit. And so, because I like it for everything, right? Like a burn or an eye infection or an ear infection or a tooth, like just anything and everything. And I'm like, okay, I'm like buying stock in silver, basically. Like it's gotten so expensive after COVID, you know? And so I'm like, I'm just going to make this. And so far I've been good. I haven't turned blue. I think I'm onto something. Okay. I think I'm doing something okay.
Yeah. You just have to be really mindful and make sure you're making it properly, because that's usually where you run into trouble, is when you're ingesting the improper form and it's a salt, a silver salt.
Yes.
When you run into trouble.
Yes. Okay. Perfect. Awesome tips. And so when you started your journey, were you under the care of a physician, or were you taking care of yourself? Were you kind of figuring it out? Sounds like maybe you didn't know a whole lot about Lyme as you were reading about it. So I'm kind of curious to see or to hear what made you decide which way you chose, right? And kind of where you went from there.
Well, you know, I probably, if there's anything I could change, I would change this part. I would go to a Lyme literate doctor and not just treat myself, because I treated myself. And I like to experiment on myself, for better or for worse. I like to try things and taste things and see what works and what doesn't, so I can gain that experience, because then I can share that with patients.
Which is a fantastic thought, but maybe not when you're really sick with Lyme.
Maybe not. You know, I might have gotten better, different, faster. Live and learn, right? Who knows, right? But I went, I sought out training, right? So I went to ILADS and started learning what to do here, and put myself on, you know, I started with doxycycline and built up from there. And then when I needed to stop antibiotics, I switched to herbs, and I started reading books by Stephen Buter, and, you know, just trying different things on myself to see what worked and what didn't. And then I heard about the IVs, and I did find somebody to go get IVs from. I didn't do that myself, and I needed to have the whole setup,
right?
Which I didn't have. But yeah, I mean, if I could change something, I probably would go to, you know, of course, now I know people, now I know all that Lyme literate docs exist, and I would go to one of them and make them help me feel better. But I just jumped in, and I said, I got to do something. Right. I don't feel well. There's something going on. This is an explanation. I got to try it. And so I just jumped in and started treating myself.
Practicing. Okay. Well, obviously it worked, right? Because you're well. So you treated yourself the whole way?
I did.
Awesome. Yeah. Okay. And that was, how long was your journey?
I was in treatment for 5 to 8 years.
Okay.
Full blown, mostly for 5, and then kind of shorter for, like, less so for 8. And now I keep myself balanced with a lot of non-regimented things these days. I have IVs, so I can get IV therapies and other boosters. And I take some supplements on and off and just kind of adjust according to what life is throwing at me.
Right.
At this point. Yeah.
And I think that's important too, because, I've been in remission for about 3.5 years and symptom free. It's been amazing, but I'll still do, like, I still take my silver every day, right? Just not a lot, just a little bit. I drink my cistus tea. I have a vibe plate. I have a bio, like, I just do things randomly, right? Because I've already invested in them, so I may as well use them. And I just love the whole idea of what silver is and cistus tea. Those are my two favorite things and kind of my go-tos. And then, you know, when life just throws craziness, I throw in some binders periodically, right? Like, our world is toxic, our food is toxic. And so I think it's really important that when people get well, we don't go on either side. We don't go on the side of, I'm done with everything, right? Let me get my life back. But then we also don't go on the side of, oh, maybe I just need to keep taking this treatment regimen, right? Just forever, just so I stay well. Like, there's kind of that fine line. Do you know what I'm saying? Like, I think you need to find what works for you and to keep your immunity boosted, right?
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that journey, the bridge, I will say, from sick person to healthy person is a hard bridge to cross. Mm-hmm. You know, and I, speaking from experience, you get so used to being unwell and you get so used to thinking ahead and thinking, well, I can't do that because I'm going to do this. If I'm going to do this and I can't do that and I'm going to need to rest. And, you know, like, you're in that sick mentality, in that self-preservation mentality for so long. And when you start to have some freedom to be able to go outside of that and do things that you want to do, it's terrifying. Yeah. At one point, it's exhilarating and it's really easy to overdo it. And it's when you overdo it and you go back to that deep, dark place because you have a bad day and you think, I'm never going to get better. You know, so it's this juggle and it's the struggle between where you were and where you want to be. And so that bridge, I think, is a really important part of the healing journey for everyone who goes through this, to acknowledge, hey, that's where I was. That was hard. I'm proud of myself because look at where I am now and look at where I'm going to be.
Yes.
And how do I get myself there and start to think differently and remind myself I can do this. I have this. I am tough. And that conversation you have to have with yourself, you know, it gets easier and easier and easier to do.
Right.
But we all get there, and you still have bad days, you know, 3 years in where you can go, oh, seriously?
Yeah.
But you just, you know, you have to kind of work through that. But that bridge and that to healing is, it's a big step and it's important. And it's also important to, like, be proud of yourself.
Yes.
That you've come on that journey.
Yes. I always say celebrate all the wins, right? All the little ones, because it's a lot of little ones that get us to where we want to be.
Absolutely.
So now that we're talking about kind of this bridge going over, right, how, you being a practitioner, how much of an impact do you feel that our mental health, our emotional state is during our journey and or to continue to fully heal?
Oh, huge.
Love it.
Huge. You know, limbic system repair, vagus nerve repair, this is a big conversation that we have at least once, if not 16,000 times with every patient that comes in, because I think that's such a huge part of this. And our brains, God love it, they want to protect us, right? And so they can get stuck in this inflammatory trauma loop. that is very akin, if not exactly the same, as a PTSD trauma loop from psychological trauma, where your brain is just thinking, aren't you proud of me? I'm sending out inflammation because, you know, this, you know, infection is here. And that process of saying, okay, that was important 2 years ago. I hear you, but we don't have to react that way anymore, brain. Like, we don't have to send out all that inflammation. We can react differently. Is a huge reckoning and part of the process. And in no way, shape, or form are we making this up. This is not all in our heads. Full stop. This is very real physiological changes that our system has gone through. The good news is we can start to reverse it so that the brain can stop overreacting. Then, because the brain, the neuro and the immune system are one and the same. They're so intertwined, you can't really peel them apart. And we've got to find ways to get ourselves out of that chronic fight or flight or freeze, even worse.
Right.
Yeah. To help us on that healing journey. And it's so hard because a lot of the symptoms from these infections are psychological. Bartonella makes people angry.
Yep.
And mean. And they're not doing it on purpose. It's a symptom of their brain inflammation.
Yep.
You know, babesia makes people really anxious and not necessarily delusional, but they depersonalize and they have deja vu and they're kind of outside of their bodies. And again, this is a symptom of the brain inflammation from their infection.
Right.
And it's really hard.
It is, you know, and I jokingly say, right, like we have to laugh sometimes along this journey, right? Or we would just be in tears every day. But I say, you know, for many listeners out there, myself included, I heard for years from all these doctors, oh, it's all in your head, you're stressed, you're overworked. And you know, the funny thing is that yeah, a lot of it was in my head, right? The Lyme was in my head causing all of these issues. So it really is. I always just think that's kind of funny because I'm like, you know, they kind of were right. They didn't know it though. But yeah.
It's not what they meant, but yeah, they were.
Exactly. Exactly. That's about the only credit I'll give them.
That's so sad. It's so true because so many of patients come into my office and they've been dealing with these chronic issues for 5, 10, 15, 20 years. And they just get told over and over again, your labs are normal. There's nothing wrong with you. Here's a number for a psychiatrist.
Yes.
That's awful.
Instead of being curious, right? Instead of being curious. Yeah. It's, you know, and we've come so far in the last, you know, even just decade about, you know, having more practitioners out there that are, one, along the lines of the holistic world, right? Because that's where my heart lies. But then just people, doctors that are familiar with it, right? Like they'll actually acknowledge it now, you know, because, and it does still happen, but I mean, you can have somebody in Connecticut and they're like, oh no, not Lyme disease, right? But you're giving them all the symptoms, right? And they're still like, no, not possible. Like, it's just crazy to me. But we've come a long way since then, and we have a lot more improvement to go and a longer way to go for sure. But it's just interesting that, yeah, these doctors. Anyways, we could go on a whole nother topic about that, right? And so along your journey, I think you mentioned the silver and the ozone was kind of a big needle mover for you. And you kind of said each one was. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's an important point to make for the listeners out there. You know, some of them have been struggling with the same kind of treatment protocol for a while. They're not seeing the needle move. I think there's a couple different types of people that go through this journey. One, they want to throw everything at it all at one time, right? I truly feel that you need to pick a pathway, go down that pathway and be dedicated to it, right? For 3, 4, 5, 6 months. If then you're not seeing any type of improvement, then maybe it's time to change things up. But you don't know if something's going to work if you're on a path and you just keep throwing things at it, right? Like I think it can be very confusing, but I know that they do it out of being desperate, right? Like they They know what's wrong with them. They finally, it took them how many years to get their diagnosis. Now I just want to kill it and get rid of it. So what are your kind of thoughts on when you start a protocol? Like, do you change things up periodically? Do you change them up based on like what type of testing do you do? Do you do muscle testing? Do you, like, I don't know a lot about, you know, your practice that you do. And so it would just be kind of nice to hear from your perspective on kind of where you go with that.
Yeah. Well, it's very individualized care. So we really yes. try to meet people where they are and what works for them and what makes sense for them. And based on our clinical experience and the labs, et cetera, kind of putting it all together and deciding where to go. And so that could be prescription antibiotics. It could be herbal antibiotics. It could be gut healing first and foremost. Maybe we really have to touch on the mold first. You know, we also do have IV therapies. We have SOT. We have other options for patients as well. So I have a big toolbox to pull from, but I let the patient guide me. And this is where, you know, I've had providers ask me to create a step-by-step algorithm basically for how I do this. And I wish I could, because it's so complex that I'm not sure I could get it all on one sheet, you know, because each patient has so many different things. And the Lyme in one person is going to behave very differently than Lyme in the next person, because that person also has Babesia. And that's going to be different than the person who also has mold. And that's going to be different than the person who also has, you know, anaplasmosis.
Right.
So
right. There's so many different.
There's so many different combinations.
Yeah.
And, you know, even just Lyme itself, there's so many different combinations of how it can present in the human body. It's why we call it the great mimicker, because the same bug can present as arthritis in one patient, POTS in another patient, depression in another, you know? So there's no straightforward way to treat it. But I agree with you, if we're going down one route and it's not working, we need to shift gears. Or if we've plateaued, that's yes. when we need to shift gears and do something different to see, to maybe we need to look again at the labs. Maybe there's something that's now come up that wasn't there before, something hidden that we can find. Or if you're just really not responding well to prescriptions, maybe we need to do herbals or vice versa.
And do just, you kind of have a time frame for that? Again, everybody's yeah. different, but do you got to give it at least, you know, 3 months, or where yeah. does your thoughts lie?
You
on
do.
That?
I mean, you generally do need to give it a good 3 months or so before you start changing it, unless you cannot tolerate it. If you can't,
right.
If you cannot function, clearly we need to switch it up faster, but I want to get through the like 3 life cycles of the bacteria to see where we are and what's happening. So usually kind of 3 month chunks okay. in there to adjust along the way sooner if necessary. But yeah, you got to kind of let it sit for a bit, because you got to get through the herxy type of rigmarole, and you've got to work through that layer and keep, you know, until you can kind of see, okay, this is really working, or this worked. But now I'm plateaued again.
Yes,
you
yes.
know, what's next?
Mm-hmm. Yes. And, you know, and I've told people over the years that, you know, they'll buy a, you know, pile of this and they're like, no, it didn't work. That doesn't mean that might not be your needle mover in 6 months. Right. Like, we yeah. don't know. That's how our bodies are just so they're incredible. They're amazing. They're unique. They're just, we just don't know. But it's our bodies are going to tell us what it needs. Right. And so don't be disappointed if you tried something and then your practitioner wants to put you back on it again down the road, because this could be your ticket now, right? That's just how it really is, just kind of this roller coaster of a journey, or it can be for sure.
Yeah, very true.
And so what type of things do you do or recommend to people as far as detoxing?
Oh yeah, detoxing is always a part of the process. And so we're usually, you know, multiple steps trying to figure out if there's big sources of toxin exposure. I'm not super big on necessarily treating mold first and then treating Lyme. I don't think they need to be so cut and dry. And I've lost a lot of time trying to follow these rigorous rules that some people will lay out. But I think everyone needs detox support. I think that's what a lot of Herxheimer type of reactions are, this overburdening of toxicity in our system. And so we have to help our system clear things out. So it's important to look and try to reduce our exposure. And that could be, you know, dirty water at your house, your air environment, your cleaning supplies, your beauty products, whatever that may be. And then we need to do two things. One is flush out the toxins and kind of open up the sink so that we have more of an exit pathway, help flush all these things. And that's usually something like glutathione, maybe some liver support, milk thistle, those kind of things.
Okay.
Dietary stuff, high sulfur foods, broccoli, cauliflower, kale, eggs, onions, fiber. Actually, that's more of a binder, which is the number two part, is to bind up the toxins, because yep. most of us have trouble with that. So we have to have some sponges in our system to kind of mop up these toxins we're flushing out. So you can literally poop them down the toilet.
Yes, because if you're just killing them and they're just sitting there, right, that's not good. You're just recirculating all exactly. this toxicity back in your body, which yeah. we're trying so hard not to let in, right?
Exactly, yeah. We've got to get it out, especially if we're starting to kind of flush it and move it. And there's multiple different kinds of binders and things that we can do and other ways to help flush the system, and saunas and other things that you've kind of mentioned before today as well. But it is an important part. You can over-detox, though. I will caution this.
Yes. Thank you for saying that, because I say it, too. You can overkill, and you can also over-detox, which a lot of people, that it shocks them to know that. But you absolutely can. And, you know, it's all part of working with a practitioner that you align with, that you believe, that you trust, right? Because when you express your thoughts, your feelings, your symptoms to them, you want them to believe you, one, right? And I could be wrong. I don't even want to say wrong, right? I just could have my own opinion on this, that I think there is a level of discomfort that we go through during this journey, right? We can't just kill off and not have a sickness reaction. Like, it's probably not ever going to happen that way, right? But I also think that you don't have to be so miserable going through the journey. If you just can't function and you just, you know, you're done, you're doing, something's off. You've got to back off. You've got to slow down. You've got it. Maybe your pathways aren't open. Like, I don't know, right? So what are your thoughts on that when it comes to people that are like, you know, either whether they're too sensitive or it's just too much for them, they're trying to hold down a job, they're trying to take care of a family, right? Like, we have to survive during this too, but we have to be a little uncomfortable to get where we want. How do you define that comfort level, right?
Yeah. Well, I really let patients define it for themselves, because like you mentioned, I think there's some bit of uncomfortableness that's warranted and okay. And if you try something to help support yourself during that process, you feel yucky, you take an Epsom salt bath, it takes the edge off. Okay, this is a Herxheimer. I was warned about this. I can do this. Like, this is okay. This is manageable, right? That is different than, no, this is not going to work. I cannot function. And that level is different for every person, right? But you will know the difference. You will know the difference between I cannot do this and this is gross. Okay. So I let patients define that, because when it's not one of those no pain, no gain kind of things, because there is a limit to it. Like you mentioned, there's uncomfortableness, there's yuckiness, there's, you know, we're going to kind of push through it a little bit, but I'm going to try to give you tools to help take that edge off, to help you manage it, and it will get better and you will get through it and you'll be better on the other side. When it gets to a point where it's so bad that you are debilitated and you cannot function, you can't get out of bed, you can't take care of your kids, you can't go to work, not everybody has the luxury to be able to take 3 months off from their job, you know, with or without pay. Like, not everybody has that option, right? And if we can't get out of bed and we can't function, we can't work, that's too much. And that's actually a bigger mess for me to help you clean up than the first one.
Right.
So we've got to stop the medications or change the medications or reduce the herbs or take a look at your detox. Is it too little, too much? You know, what in your system do we need to help you get through that? Because uncomfortable is okay.
Yeah.
But, you know, we can definitely
have to be able to get to bed. And right. Exactly. Yeah. And again, like you said, that can happen from killing or detoxing. And we don't always know that, right? When we're new to this journey and we're going through it, we think, oh, we just need to kill because we want it gone, right? We know we have Lyme, let's kill it. But then, you know, so many don't even understand the whole detoxing part, or that you've got to bind it, you've got to get it out of your body. You know, there's so many different ways that, you know, practitioners will teach their patients kind of their protocols, right? And it is shocking to me when I, you know, will talk to somebody they've been treating for a couple of years and they don't even know what binders are. And I'm like, wow, right? Like, but I guess that's why, you know, I do the show so we can talk about all the different things. You know, everybody is different. Everybody's journey, like you said, is so individualized. It is, right? The big picture is, we have this miserable disease, right, called Lyme disease, and then all the other stuff that goes with it. But our treatment journeys are different, and what we can tolerate are different. I just think that it's important to really kind of be in tune with your body. And again, like I said, resonate with your practitioner. I think that that is huge, right? Mm-hmm. You want somebody who's going to validate what you're feeling. They can't mm-hmm. be like, oh, well, most people push through this, no problem. Or we're not most people, we're this person, yeah. right? Yeah. And I think that's where we really need to kind of break that barrier of we're all individuals.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I have patients ranging, you know, who are on a handful of different antibiotics. I mean, multiple. It's wild, but they are thriving, and that is how they exist. And they are doing really, really well. Their blood work is good, and they're, you know, we're monitoring that. And I have other patients, if you open an herbal bottle in front of them and kind of with it at them, they have a herx, right? Yeah. So this is why I'm saying, like, there is no algorithm. There's no cut and dry. Well, if A, then B, then C. It's, you know, where are you? What do you have going on? How, what do you prefer? How do you react to things? How do we need to tailor this to you in your life, in your body? And that's what makes it so complicated, but it also makes it really beautiful. And it's really fun to figure out all these nuances of the individual person and meet them where they are. You really have to meet each patient where they are and adjust. Yes. Because if we might think, we might go into this and our eyes might be bigger than our stomach, and we think we can eat the entire cake, and we can't, and we have to be okay saying, okay, all right, time to shift gears.
Yes. I'll try something different. Yes. Yes. Yeah. You know, so you've mentioned antibiotics a lot. And so my personal take on antibiotics, and I'm sure those of you that are listening that have been following me for, you know, the last 4 years, they kind of know where my thoughts are on it. And my thoughts are, if you get a fresh bite, absolutely throw in those antibiotics. Like, I think it's a perfect time for it, right? When it comes to being chronically ill with Lyme, you know, we've been sick for many years, undiagnosed. My thought is, don't let it be your first choice, right? I think that we battle a lot of, you know, gut issues and just a lot of other things when we throw antibiotics into the mix. But again, I'm not saying it's not a choice. It just wouldn't be my first choice. But then you have to stop and look, are you somebody who's really sensitive to herbs? Like you said, maybe antibiotics are better. So how do you and again, kind of a tough question because everybody's different, but how do you decide whether you want to go the antibiotic route with somebody, and what type of protocols do you do to help keep their gut in order while they're doing this? Because I know that that's one of the big problems with antibiotics, is that it destroys our gut, right? And mm-hmm. probably we already have a messed up gut. So now we're just adding to the problem, right? Yes. So how do you handle that?
Yeah. I wish there was a cut and dry, you know, if this, then we give antibiotics, you know. Yeah. A lot of it goes with just medical intuition and the clinical experience and just what feels right for that patient, but it's the conversation, you know. So if the patient is saying, I really, really want to do antibiotics, then I think we need to honor that and give that a go. If someone has said, no, absolutely not, do not, I don't want an antibiotic, then we're not going to use antibiotics if we don't have to. Chronic Lyme is a different beast, right? So I think antibiotics have their place and they can be very useful and they can help, but they have a lot of downsides. you have to watch the gut, you have to watch the liver, you have to monitor this, you have to worry about creating superbugs and all these other things into the mix. But for some people, they just work better. I wish there were simple blood tests I could point out to you and say, you know, if their AST
you
is
need
47,
you
this
need
is,
herbs.
You know,
yeah,
that would make my life easier. But when we're going to go on antibiotics, I want to be on them for the shortest amount of time possible. Knowing though that these are stealth chronic infections. They are akin to tuberculosis, and everyone knows tuberculosis, right? We know that people used to go convalesce for a year when they had, chronic tuberculosis, and they'd be on antibiotics the whole time because you needed to treat it for that long to get anywhere near treating it and killing this. And Bartonella and Lyme and these things are no different. So they do require long-term treatment, whether that's prescription or herbal or what have you. It takes a long time to get to the deeper rooted arms of these infections and really treat them. But one of the biggest issues with antibiotics is the gut. And you can get a really, really foul smelling, watery diarrhea called C. difficile. No one wants this. It's really nasty. The way to really try to prevent that, and knock on wood, we've been able to do a good job of it, is probiotics. You know, really high dose, good quality probiotics. So I'm putting people on 100 billion colony unit probiotics plus some Saccharomyces, which is a good yeast, or I'm doing a spore-based probiotic, or we're kind of doing all of the above. Separate from the antibiotics, you don't take them all at the exact same time, take them at different parts of the day, but that's kind of a big mainstay. So if you're going to do the antibiotics, you got to do the probiotics. And I usually still get probiotics when we're on herbs too, just to help keep that, but I may not have to use it strong.
Right.
Because the herbs are gentler usually.
Gotcha.
On the gut. But it's, you got to monitor it too. I mentioned we check blood work. We make sure liver levels are okay and other things because, you know, we first do no harm. So you have to make sure that what we're doing is actually helping.
Right.
And not causing more problems.
Right.
Yeah.
And do you kind of have timelines for when you do blood work? Do you do it every time a patient comes to see you? Do you do it every 3 months, every 6 months in general? Or obviously if they're having some issues, I'm assuming that you just jump on and do them. But that is, they're kind of like a standard. If all is good, everything seems okay, do we check them, you know, every other visit, every 3 months, 6 months?
Just depends on what they've got going on. You know, certain medications I might have to check every week or two or four.
Okay.
Just to monitor things. I try not to do it very often. If the lab value is not going to change my treatment plan, I try not to do it. I'm not just checking blood for academic purposes. I'm not just checking to make sure, you know, if I need to check it to make sure you're safe. Or to change treatment protocols or make sure we're on the right path, then I'll do it. If we're holding steady and things are progressing and we're doing really well and like your liver's been fine the entire time and we're doing this and that, I may not check it quite as often. So it really depends on the person and where they are and what's going on and how often we'll treat it. Yeah. Or check it.
Awesome. Yeah. And it is hard. You know, it's hard to be a practitioner and be able to kind of express how you do what you do, right? Because everybody's so individualized. It's also kind of hard, you know, to take somebody's 20, 30, 40-year Lyme journey and cram it into a 40-minute podcast, right? Like, we do all the impossible things. Dr. Kelly, this has been great. Lots of good information shared. I loved that you were able to treat yourself, but then, you know, kind of hindsight, you're like, yeah, maybe I would have got faster. I think one of my kind of points that I could change up, one is that I probably should have become my own advocate before I did, right? It took me 7 years, ended up bedridden with a caregiver and didn't know my name before I decided, oh, I'm going to die if I don't figure this out. Wish I would have got smart sooner. And then I think that one of the missing pieces for me was that whole mental aspect of it. You know, Lyme changed me. I'm a different person. Did I grieve the old person? Did I welcome the new person? You know, how do you move back into society after you get well? How do I go from not knowing my name and not knowing what a checkbook is to trying to tell somebody, hey, I'm smart, you know, you should hire me, right? Like it's this journey and it's this process. And I truly believe that repairing that is part of the journey, right? Mm-hmm. It's the killing, the detoxing, all of that, and dealing with the emotional aspects.
Yeah,
and maybe you have some blocked trauma from when you were a child, and that does not mean you were abused in any way. I mean, that could be as far as you had a rough delivery and the doctor used forceps on your head, right? There could be all sorts of types of blocked traumas in our bodies that we are totally unaware of, right? I just think it's a huge piece to our healing journey. So that's what I would have done differently for sure, is I wish I would have known that you needed to deal with this emotional side of it during your journey. Mm-hmm. I didn't. I learned a little late, right?
Yeah. And honestly, the people that I can convince to do that work get better faster, stay better longer.
Love it. That's what I want to hear. Yeah. I believe it. I believe it. So, well, awesome. We will be sure to put your information in the title to your episode so the listeners can reach out to you. If they have questions, they want to chat with you and just learn all about you. So thank you so, so much for your time and sharing all of your wonderful information with us.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. And thank you for sharing your journey with the world.
I sure hope you listeners enjoyed that episode. Whether it's hope you needed, a little inspiration today, or just maybe some validation that what you're feeling, what you're going through is real. Maybe you needed tips on how to treat at home, ideas, thoughts, detoxing, whatever it is. I truly just hope it's what you got out of today's episode. That is my only hope, is just to give back to this community in any way possible. So go to the about of this podcast, scroll down to the bottom and find that donation link. Go ahead and click on there, and anything that you'd like to donate or offer is all just going to go to help to pay towards the studio cost.